This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Alabama governor candidate Walt Maddox has a new ad out where he tries to connect Kay Ivey to Roy Moore. We talk about this and whether or not it's going to be a winning strategy on Tactics.
Staring, looking funny at me when I step to the window and I toss the TV.
Good morning. Welcome to Tactics. Pleasure to be with you as always on a Friday. The weekend is finally upon us. One more in the books, and summer is almost over. So, lots going on right now. Especially considering we are in the wake of the primaries, the runoff has been completed, the election season is really, it's almost kind of going to be in a dead zone. It's funny that this happens right around the time of the All-Star game, which people typically say is the slowest day in sports media, and being somebody who used to cover sports and looking back, I would say that that is true. Although now they're having SEC media days during that time, so really that's not the case anymore, which is something that really bothers me just because, well, frankly, I just like the All-Star game and I don't like anything distracting me from it. But nonetheless, it's kind of the same way in our political realm today, is that lull right after the runoffs, right after the primaries, it doesn't last long. So there is a brief pause, and then people start gearing up for the general, which has just happened. There was an ad that was put out by Walt Maddox, who is the Democrats' nominee against the Republican nominee for governor, the current governor of our state, one Kay Ivey. And the newest strategy seems to be based on this, to try to connect Kay Ivey to Roy Moore. Which is interesting, the choice in this election, I'll say this the nicest way possible. I'm not the biggest Kay Ivey fan, but that doesn't mean that I am in any way considering voting for Walt Maddox based on some of the things that he has come out and proposed. And here's his ad. This is, I guess, the latest attempt to try to go against his opponent, and if it's starting this early, I don't know exactly how this is going to end up, but this looks to be a fairly heated campaign if he's going this early with ads on Facebook and other forms of social media. So this ad popped up the other day, and it says, "The choice in this election for governor is clear. If you want a candidate who proudly voted for Roy Moore, even though she said she believed the women who accused him, Kay Ivey has earned your vote." So, I know that there's a lot of mixed feelings about Judge Moore in the state, and frankly, I understand them. I don't necessarily agree with all the feelings, but I certainly do understand where people are coming from on that. But regardless of how you feel about Roy Moore, all feelings about Roy Moore aside, this is politically really stupid to make this your play. And I don't know if this is going to be a centerpiece of his campaign. I don't know if the main vehicle that he uses to attack Kay Ivey is going to be this. But if that is the case, if he makes this a big centerpiece for his campaign, then that is ridiculously stupid when it comes to this, just from a standpoint of whether or not you can get votes. So all feelings about Moore aside, let's look at this as objectively as possible. First of all, what he is doing in this is he is saying that essentially because Kay Ivey voted for Roy Moore, she's a bad person and thus does not deserve to hold public office, which is a message that probably plays pretty well with the Democrats and the advisors surrounding him. But that's not going to be a winning message when it comes to the state of Alabama, because what you are doing is at that point you are publicly demonizing people who voted for Roy Moore because you're doing so with Kay Ivey, but you are by extension implying that anybody that did vote for Roy Moore is a bad person, which means you are already out of the gate alienating about half the state when you do so, or at least half the state when it comes to likely voters. Remember that Doug Jones barely won that election by 1.5%, meaning that at the very least, the 650,000 people that voted for Roy Moore, who are likely voters, and these are people who voted in a special election, which means they're very likely to turn out for a larger general election, which usually has a far higher turnout. If that is the case, then that means he is already basically throwing those 650,000 voters away right out of the gate. Not a smart thing to do politically. If you're going to demonize everyone who voted for Roy Moore, then by extension, of course, all those people are included in that category. And you have another thing to worry about. A lot of people now that did not vote for Roy Moore retroactively look back at that and wish that they would have. In other words, there's a lot of people that didn't vote for Roy Moore that if they're looking back at it right now and they're looking at the job that Senator Doug Jones has done, because keep in mind this is a very conservative state, Doug Jones has been one of the worst senators, not just from the state of Alabama, but period. I mean, if you're judging it from the scale of I want somebody that votes conservatively, which most of the people in the state of Alabama do, and you're looking at Doug Jones, he literally has not cast one single vote in favor of the conservatism. There's a reason that he has a 0% rating by FreedomWorks. I mean, the guy just, he does not vote conservatively. He votes like a radical Democrat, right along with Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Actually, they both have better records than him, if you're looking at it from the standpoint of a conservative. And so, because of that, looking back at that and really understanding what that means, I'm sorry, I have to correct myself. That was 0% from Conservative Review, 10% from FreedomWorks. So abysmal, regardless of what scale you're looking at, but a voting record that is worse than Elizabeth Warren, Chuck Schumer, and Nancy Pelosi. The average Alabamian is not going to be ingratiated or motivated to vote for Doug Jones for that. And because of that, they're looking back at not voting for Roy Moore, and a lot of those people are regretting it, which means they would relate to Kay Ivey's decision to vote for Roy Moore. So you're not only alienating those 650,000 voters, you're also alienating a lot of people that look back and retroactively wish that they had turned out to vote and vote for Roy Moore. Because had Jones come out and been a moderate blue dog Democrat, somebody like Joe Manchin that still typically votes with the Democrats, but at least occasionally votes with the Republicans and occasionally takes a stance on things like life, things like gun rights. If that had been the case, if Doug Jones had come out as a moderate senator, there would be a lot of those people that are looking back at that vote that didn't vote for Roy Moore and say, you know what, maybe his vote isn't as good or reliable as Roy Moore's would have been, but okay, I see that and I can live with it. But because he has been that bad, there are a lot of people retroactively looking back and wishing that they had voted for Judge Roy Moore. And you have to keep in mind that there were a lot of people that did not turn out for Roy Moore, also because they felt, well, this is a ruby red state. There's no way we're ever going to elect a Democrat senator, so Roy Moore is going to win anyway. And so had they been at the polls, they would have voted for Roy Moore, but didn't. Now, these are people that are less likely to show up in the midterm election coming up later this year. But there's still going to be some of them that do, because like I said, this is a larger election. There's more people that you can pick from. There's more races that you can vote on. And because of that, there's going to be a higher turnout. I mean, that's just the way that it goes. Special elections have notoriously low turnouts. And so there's going to be a whole lot of people that would have voted for Roy Moore, but didn't turn out because they thought that it was safe and thought that he was going to win, that now do not have any illusions about that because Doug Jones won, and now are going to be more motivated to go to the polls to ensure that somebody like Doug Jones doesn't wind up winning it anyway. They will feel more motivated to make sure that there are people that are more reflective of their values holding office. And that's another group of people that Walt Maddox is alienating by running an ad in this fashion. And so this is something that they're less likely to do because It's one thing that if you were kind of lackluster about Moore, you didn't really want to vote for him, you didn't really want to vote for Doug Jones, you kind of felt that they were both bad, you probably would have sided with Moore had you voted, but you weren't real motivated to get out and vote for either one of them because you didn't like them. A lot of those people are going to be going to the polls in November because even if there's, let's say that, you know, they do feel that way about Kay Ivey and they don't much care for her, they're still more likely to turn out because they may still want to vote for Secretary of State. They still may want to vote for Commissioner of Agriculture. There may be one or two races that they feel really passionate about. And because of that, they go and they're going to vote and tend to side more with the Republicans than the Democrats. And so, again, Maddox is just alienating people left and right in this state if he's doing so. So if this is Walt Maddox's play, ironically, in a roundabout way, the performance of Doug Jones may actually wind up helping Kay Ivey. I mean, I'm not saying that for sure, but if you think about it, if this becomes a big centerpiece of the election and Walt Maddox keeps hammering this issue over and over, and I don't know that he will, it may have just been a one-off ad and he never mentions it again, but if he brings this up and if this becomes one of his primary modes of attack against Kay Ivey, ironically, Doug Jones' voting record may actually wind up helping Kay Ivey get elected. So again, all feelings and biases aside, or at least doing the best that I can to do so, I just think that politically, this is a ridiculously stupid move. Just from a political standpoint, just from a standpoint of getting votes. I think there's not a good explanation, not a good... There's really not a good reason to go forward with this because you're intentionally moving voters away from yourself. You're alienating voters that might otherwise at least consider voting for you. That's my stance. I know that it's going to be an uphill battle, and so he's going to have to be bold. He's going to have to be very brash when it comes to attacking Kay Ivey. I get that, but I just think if you're trying to ingratiate people that may be more conservative than you, this is not a smart move. This is not the way to go for it. 860-1440. Love to hear your thoughts on this. Are you a Roy Moore voter? And if so, what do you think about this? Were you somebody that didn't vote for Roy Moore but is still going to vote for Kay Ivey? Love to hear your thoughts on that. 860-1440. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. John Jay, 1st Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 is the way to weigh in if you would like to do so. And we were talking before the break about this new ad by Walt Maddox trying to connect Kay Ivey to Roy Moore and talk about how she voted for Roy Moore and all this stuff, which I think politically is a massive misstep, at least in this state. Now, if we're living in a blue state or a purple state, where I think a purple state even would be justifiable, because while you would certainly be alienating most of the Republican voters, you at least stand a chance of getting the middle, and that might be just enough to squeeze out over 50% or at least the amount that you need to defeat your opponent for governor. That is not going to be the case when it comes to a ruby red conservative state. So, I mean, if you were running in a place like Florida, which has a pretty good mix, or maybe Ohio or something like that, that may not be a bad play. But in a very conservative state like Alabama, when you're running for a statewide election, that's just not smart. If he were running in here in Montgomery, if he were running in the city of Birmingham for mayor or something like that, somewhere where there's a lot of Democrat voters, okay, I can see connecting your opponent to Roy Moore as being a decent play, because while you do alienate the most conservative and you alienate the people that stood by Roy Moore, even with all the allegations going on, you at least stand a chance of the people who were lackluster on Roy Moore, them coming over to your side. That's really just not going to happen, at least not in the numbers that he would need it to win the election. And so I think this alienates far more voters than it might ingratiate himself to, because that's going to get the people that were very anti-Roy Moore, but those people were probably already going to vote for Walt Maddox anyway, and so there's really not a... I mean, maybe it whips up his base some, then motivates them to get out to vote, but it's not going to change any minds, I guess is the best way to say it. And it's going to, like I said, it's going to change at least a few minds in that they will decide that they don't want to vote for Walt Maddox because he's actually demonizing them by extension by going after anybody who voted for Roy Moore. So really, I think that this is a perfect example of how dangerous living in an echo chamber is, especially in the realm of politics. So on the left, Judge Moore is a universally despised figure, and he's kind of a laughing stock. People make fun of him, and that's fine. I mean, I guess if that's where you are and you're in circles around other Democrats that agree with you on that. And like I said, to all the people surrounding Walt Maddox who are advising him that are Democrats themselves, they probably looked at this and said, yeah, this is a really effective ad. I've got a buddy who we talked about this over social media, over the political wisdom of this ad, and he thought it was a great idea. Well, of course he did. He loves Doug Jones. He said that Doug Jones was the senator that has done more for them than any other senator in recent Alabama history, which is, I mean, character, it's incredibly untrue, and we could go into all the particulars on that, but that's really a discussion for another time. My point in all that is, for the people who really liked Doug Jones and hated Roy Moore, yeah, it is an effective ad, but those people were probably already going to vote for Walt Maddox, and there's not that many of those people in the state of Alabama. So if you're looking at it from a purely political sense, I just think this is a dumb move. But if you're living in that echo chamber where everybody is reaffirming you and saying, oh yeah, this is a great ad, I really like that ad, if everybody is just going through and giving you a thumbs up on it, then you think that this is a really effective play. It would have behooved Maddox and his team to actually get together with at least a few conservatives or a few people that it would have at least considered voting for Roy Moore and get their opinions on it. But of course, that didn't happen. And not to say that this doesn't happen on the right, too. There are plenty of people on the right that get into an echo chamber that they only talk to people that they agree with. I'm afraid that we are increasingly more and more doing that, in part because of social media. We're creating our own little bubble where the only thing that we're getting is positive feedback from people that already think like we do, and we're never challenged on our ideas. But that's exactly what happened, so far as I can tell, with Walt Maddox's decision to release this ad, and because everybody around him thought it was a good idea, thought it was really effective, then he thought the same thing, and they put it out there, and when it's consumed by the general Alabama citizen, that is not going to play well. And here's really where I think this is all coming from. I think what Walt Maddox is doing and his thinking behind coming up with this ad is he's trying to recreate the conditions that surrounded that race. But there's a couple reasons why that's not going to work. First of all, there's at least one degree of separation. I would say that it's even further apart than normal. To my knowledge, Kay Ivey was never somebody that was particularly close with Roy Moore. I mean, it's not as though she had a long-standing relationship. Now, she voted for the guy, but that means that she has about the same relationship with Roy Moore as the average person does. I mean, maybe not me in particular, because I've interviewed him, I've actually spoken to him, I know a lot of people that are friends of his, I know a lot of people over at the Foundation for Moral Law, but the average voter, their relationship with Roy Moore was not much more distant than Kay Ivey's relationship with Roy Moore, which again puts Kay Ivey in the position in this ad of the average Alabama voter, which demonizes them as well. So you've got that, and because of that, and because it was Roy Moore and his scandal that mainly led to a falling out between him and the voter, at least with them at the very minimum not being willing to turn out and vote for him, then what you have in a situation like that is that when it comes to Kay Ivey and Walt Maddox going after her, then when it comes to that particular person, I still think that that person is going to be more likely to turn out in a general election like this. And so when it comes to that, it just, if that is the person that you're going after, if the person that you're going after is somebody that was somewhat apathetic towards Judge Moore, but probably would have sided with him over Doug Jones, I just think that's a politically unwise thing to do. And so you've got those situations to where KIV already has a pretty wide degree of separation between her and Roy Moore. And on top of that, you're going to have a much larger voter turnout because this is going to be a general election as opposed to a special one. And so because of that, it's going to be impossible to recreate the circumstances that got Doug Jones elected. I get that that's probably where Walt Maddox is going with this, and that's a strategy, but it's just not a smart play because all the circumstances just about it are completely different. And so even if you're a Democrat, even if you're on the left that thinks Roy Moore is a joke and that anybody that ever voted for him is beyond redemption, the point is, whether or not you believe that, the average Alabama voter doesn't believe that. And so again, from a strictly political standpoint, I think that this is going to be proved to be a disastrous move and a disastrous decision on Walt Maddox's part, especially if he makes this a big part of his campaign. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe you see it a different way, and that's fine. If you want to comment on it, you want to talk to me about that, happy to do so. 860-1440. And we'll be right back with some other folks on the left that are living in an echo chamber. We go to Keith Ellison in just a second.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Matthew 22:37-40. And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets."
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with us if you have a desire to do so. If not, well, I really can't help you. But anyway, 860-1440 is the way to get in touch with us, and you can always tweet at Tactics Radio. So the other day, there was a interview that was done by Keith Ellison, and for those of you who are unaware of who that is, he is a really big player in the Democrat Party. He is the deputy chief of the DNC, so he's second in command only to the chairman of the DNC, and it was a big fight in the DNC last year. He almost became the chair, so they thought that it was a little too radical. They decided to go in a different direction, but he's the second in command, the number two guy in the Democrat Party, at least from a structural perspective. And so that's who Keith Ellison is. He gave this interview the other day with a rabbi. Apparently this is a guy, I'd never heard of him before, but he's a prominent figure. And so he gave this kind of interview that was sort of a Facebook Live kind of thing. And he was just talking about illegal immigration. So there are a couple things that he said that I think is really worth breaking down and talking about. We'll go ahead and head there now. This is from that interview. This is Keith Ellison, clip one.
Or what we used to call the first world, the developed part of the globe, relies for its prosperity, let's be honest, on low wages, low levels of civil and human rights enforcement, low levels of environmental protection, in what we used to call the third world, right? And in fact, I mean, you know, so our prosperity is based on the want and that is experienced in other parts of the world. And it's important to understand that, you know, that we should give something back to make because if there's prosperity all over the globe, then why would anyone want to leave a place where they speak the language, they have their family, they know the culture, just to go to another place to be discriminated against and mistreated? It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so there's a couple things that I want to bring up here. But first of all, he asked a very good question, I think, at the end of that, which is, why would anybody leave their own culture and their own place where they know the culture, they have their family there, they're established there? Why would anybody leave there to come here? It's a very good question. And there's a very simple answer. We offer more opportunity and upward mobility than the places they're living, which are big government states where a few people control everything. And so what's so ironic about this is Keith Ellison has been a longstanding advocate for bigger government, government-controlled this, government-controlled that, government-controlled healthcare, government-guaranteed jobs, so on and so forth. And yet, he's bringing up the point, well, these third world people, they're leaving there because they obviously feel that their lives are going to be better suited here. Yes, because they have more upward mobility and more opportunity in the United States where the government is less involved in the average person's life. Where are these people coming from? Places like Mexico and Venezuela and other South American countries, the vast majority of which have very top-heavy governments that control everything. And that stifles and strangles economic prosperity and the ability to move up in your society. And so ironically, Keith Ellison actually points out the very thing that's obvious, and I think is actually a great question, but he does so in such a way that kind of counteracts the very things that he is fighting for in the Democrat Party, which all goes back to large centralized government control of every single aspect of your life. You see, under Keith Ellison's plan, the way you would spread the prosperity of the world around is not to make America and every other country around it richer, but instead to implement the policies of the third world countries and basically import the third world here. You can't just make people wealthy. Think about this. If you have one rich guy and 99 poor people and you're saying, this is so horrible, we need to equalize it. There's only one way to do that. Make everybody else as poor as everyone else. You're not going to make everybody richer doing that, and that's the problem. This whole idea that he's pushing here comes from the idea that the world and wealth is a zero-sum game. In other words, he thinks that if one group of people are rich, it's only because they must have stolen that wealth from somebody else. That wealth is a zero-sum game, except there's far more wealth now than there ever was in the world beforehand. If there's only a certain amount of wealth that can be created and wealth is a zero-sum game and everybody that is now wealthy stole it from somebody else, then why are there so many more wealthy people now than there have been at any other point in human history? I mean, even people in the third world, even though they're lagging behind quite a bit, even people in the world have marked improvements in their lives over where they used to be. Poverty is now something that is only affecting, and I'm talking about extreme poverty, it's only affecting about 10% of the entire population of the world. Just 30 or 40 years ago, it was like 50%. And so the idea that you cannot create wealth, that everybody, if you are getting wealthy, you're doing so off of the back of somebody else, that is simply not true. Now, used to, the only way to get ahead, the only way to make yourself wealthy was to steal it from somebody else. But that was back when the government acted as a hindrance to you moving up in the world. So the only way to get wealthy was to take from other people. Capitalism allows us to interact with people on a voluntary basis and create wealth for ourselves by serving other people as opposed to hurting them. And so he's actually kind of got a decent diagnosis of the problem, but his solution would do the exact opposite of what he's proposing. And here's another thing that he's disregarding too. America as a nation was wealthy long before importing cheaper goods from other places. Now, obviously, we got wealthier when we were able to import those cheaper goods. And sure, we benefit from it. But in a free market, so do they. So do they. We're getting cheaper goods that they're creating because they have lower rate wages. But they're also benefiting because, yeah, their wages may be low, but they're higher than they used to be. So here's another thing, too. Ellison's policies would just make everybody poorer. It would make us poorer, not them richer. That's what redistribution of wealth is. And eventually, when there is no incentive to create new wealth, you have even less net wealth over the entire globe. When there is no longer an incentive to make yourself wealthy, then everybody winds up equally poor. We've seen this play out in socialist and communist nations over and over and over and over again. And here's another thing I want to note. some of these nations, when he's talking about the third world, they're in very early stages in development. You don't get mad at a 7-year-old for not being able to outrun a 21-year-old. America has been doing this for a long time. There's a reason that we're referred to as the land of opportunity. It's getting less and less so, unfortunately. But the point is, you don't get mad at the third world for not being able to have the exact same standard of living as the United States. They're still in development. They're still working on it. Think about this. What would that person's life be? I mean, maybe they are working 12 hours in a shoe factory and living off of $15 a week, and that's terrible, and I want to be able to help them to do better. But what would their lives be like if they didn't have the shoe factory? Obviously, they are working there because they believe that their life is better there than it would be somewhere else. And keep in mind that in our early stages of development during the Industrial Revolution, our workforces didn't fare much better. And I'm not justifying that. All I'm saying is, you've got to give people time to develop. I mean, maybe he doesn't see his life as being all that great, but it is a vast improvement over what he would be doing if he didn't have the opportunity to work in a factory or work at a job that has been provided for him by allowing cheaper goods to be exported to other countries. And allowing more free trade is only going to get them there faster. Allowing more free trade, allowing more exchange of goods, and allowing those cheaper products to be made even more cheaply, that is going to get them to where we are much faster than if we cut off trade completely and let them do it all on their own. So, in a sense, that is actually a benefit for them. Anyway, there's a couple other things that he brings up about undocumented workers, and we will get to that in just a second. 860-1440, we'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 is the number if you want to weigh in. Let me know what is on your mind. And we have a caller on line one. Ben, good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm listening to all this, and I started thinking about Jesus, our Lord and Savior. What did he say? Well, I could fill your nets with fish. I could turn the stone and the bread and the water and the wine. I could do all of this for you. Mm-hmm. Or I could teach you how to catch the fish, make the bread and the wine, and follow me and you shall never go hungry again. Well, last time I checked, or thirst, next time I checked, the government's not God.
Okay, I'll accept that premise. And no, I'm kidding. Seriously, that's one. No, I know.
They're becoming lazy. Today, the people are just becoming lazy. If the government gives them everything, all right, does everything for them, what are they going to become? You know, we've seen in these socialist countries what happens, the outcome.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I'll use Venezuela. I use that example pretty often. And that's because they implemented every socialist tendency. And I'll have people tell me all the time, it's like, well, that's not real socialism. I'm like, okay, which policy did Hugo Chavez implement that you were against?
Yeah.
And they never can name one.
No, they can't. And this democratic socialism, what the heck are you talking about?
Well, the democratic socialism. Yeah, the democratic socialism, that's like saying it's not ice cream, it's chocolate ice cream. Yeah, but it's still ice cream. It's a different flavor maybe, but it's still the same thing.
Exactly. Thank you.
But thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. You have a good day, my friend. Always good to hear from you, especially on a Friday. But yeah, that's the issue at the core of this whole thing is that the government is not God. The government, a lot of the liberals really do want government to be their God. They want them to provide for the poor, take care of the sick, all these things. That is in the realm and the purview of God and his people. And government really sucks at doing that stuff. Every time they've tried, they failed miserably and made a mess out of it. And the longer that they try, the worse they get at it. It's one of those things that socialism is, it feels good, it sounds right, it's all warm and fuzzy, but it never works. And eventually, after some time, I mean, after you've given it enough time and you look at it and you see how it's not working, you've got to say, okay, maybe we need to try something else. Chairman Mao, for example, for 2 years tried programs to try to feed people with regulating prices when it came to food, regulating the way that food was distributed, regulating farms and everything that was going on there. And after 2 years, after he had starved 10 million people, he was like, you know what? Not my best idea. But that's the problem with top-heavy government, is that bad ideas tend to continue on and people tend to think that they're right. And because of that, they will continue with a bad idea even if people are being hurt by it. The advantage of having a free market system, a free market economy, is that bad ideas tend to go away very quickly, because as soon as people don't like an idea, they stop buying it. And there's absolutely nothing to say that free markets are absolutely perfect and people don't have perfect knowledge, and I understand that. But bad ideas go away much faster in a free market economy because nobody is going to starve for very long. And by contrast, only good ideas wind up getting through because that's the only place that people are willing to spend their money, on ideas that happen to be pretty good. And so what you eventually have is a leveling off there. And this is something that Keith Ellison doesn't seem to understand. Let's go ahead and play another clip from him. This is, again, Keith Ellison, who is the deputy head of the DNC.
They're leaving because, take for example, Mexico. Since NAFTA, Mexican wages have dropped between 9% and 13%. Now, some people have said to me, oh, Keith, you know, that's too bad for them. And my answer is, no, that's too bad for us, because that means those people are going to be a low wage sector, not only in Mexico, but in here in the United States. And the only and an undocumented worker is an exploited worker. That we just have to say that the 12 million undocumented people in the United States are here because somebody wants them to be. But what they want them here to do the work, but they don't want them to get any rights. They don't want to pay them fairly. They don't want them to be able to bargain collectively. They don't want them to be able to get occupational safety and standards. And that is what's really going on.
Okay, now here's the thing, and I know this is going to surprise people. There is a hefty amount of truth in what he just said. A illegal alien is an exploited worker. They essentially operate in a shadow labor market to where they are not given the opportunity to stand up for themselves. They are not given the opportunity to, because they have no legal rights, and because of that, there is no law there to protect them. And that is a problem. There are people that are taking advantage of that situation and taking advantage of the workers themselves, because they know that what's the worker going to do? Go to the police? If he does, he's going to have to deal with ICE. And so because they know that the workers are in that situation, there are employers out there that are not playing by the rules, that are breaking the law by hiring these people and exploiting their labor at a very low cost to them. And so, yes, actually, he is correct in his assessment there. The problem is, the American exploitation apparently is better, according to Keith Ellison's own logic, than living in a socialist country. So as bad as that exploitation is, and it is, don't get me wrong, but as bad as that is, they still view it as better to be exploited in a free market nation as opposed to living under the thumb of the all-powerful government in whatever country they came from. That ought to be telling to Keith Ellison right there. And this is an argument that really lends itself to, well, the conclusion is we need to close the border and crack down on employers that are doing this because they are exploiting people. But Keith Ellison's party actually opts for the exact opposite. They'd rather have open borders, and they would rather just kind of look the other way when employers hire these people, because it brings more people in to vote for them. And so the irony in all of this is Keith Ellison is actually right on the problem, but his party has been the one that is pushing policies that brings more of these people in to be exploited by some Americans that don't want to play by the rules and do want to exploit people that are in a bad situation. And by the way, I do want to real quickly go over this. He claims that since NAFTA, wages in Mexico have gone down 9% to 13%. I looked this up and I couldn't figure out exactly where he was drawing that. And then finally I found a study done by Gordon H. Hansen by the University of California at San Diego. The only issue with that study, even though I thought the study itself was actually pretty good, is it was done in 2003, 15 years ago. Since then, the Consumer Price Index to measure, which the study that he's citing used, since 2003, the average Mexican wage, CPI, has jumped from 75 to 130. That is a 73% increase in Mexican wages. So that goes back to exactly what I was saying. Trade has actually helped people in these third world countries. Hour two is coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
We have one more clip from Keith Ellison. I think this one is the most dangerous one yet. We go there now on Tactics. Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Welcome back to the Situation Room for Hour 2, last hour of the week. We are going to be wrapping things up here in just a second. We've been listening right before the top of the hour, for those of you who are just tuning in. We were listening to some clips with an interview that Keith Ellison, who is the deputy head of the DNC, he did this just, I think, yesterday. And did this interview, very telling stuff from Keith Ellison and some of the things that he has been bringing forward. And he was talking about illegal immigrants, or as he would call them, undocumented workers, which you can call them whatever you want. They're still illegal immigrants. And he's bringing this up. And by the way, if any of this so far has sounded like protectionism, sounded like protecting workers, that's because it is. That's because protectionism is a hallmark of both democratic socialism and national socialism. So people that are uber nationalists believe in protectionism, but the global socialists also believe in protectionism, just in different ways. And so the implementation is a little bit different, but they both are not fans of free markets and prefer some type of protectionism when it comes to companies. So we're going to go ahead and listen to this last clip, and I think this one is actually the one that is most telling. This is where he kind of gives his solution and what he thinks should be done about illegal immigration as a whole. This is Keith Ellison.
And these trade agreements, you know, what they allow capital to travel over borders, and all capital is people who happen to own something we call a corporation, which is a legal arrangement which gives them special rights, and labor, which is a regular person, cannot travel back and forth across the border. And so corporations, certain people who get certain rights, can go back and forth across the border seeking out the lowest wages, but people, regular people, cannot go back and forth across the border seeking out the highest wages. So what it creates is an imbalance, it creates an injustice, and it creates the need for something like a global Marshall Plan.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there. If that doesn't terrify you, I don't know what does. A global Marshall Plan, so he intends to have what, an international police force just governing this whole thing? And who would be footing the bill for that? I assume that he's proposing that it would be the United States, since we tend to foot the bill for every other international organization. But yeah, a global Marshall Plan, that's not really something that I'm going to be able to get on board with. The idea that there ought to be some kind of governing body that takes over, and other than the United States, that they're the ones that decide who gets to cross the border and who doesn't get to cross the border, and who's illegal and who's not illegal. And basically what he is proposing there is just open borders. So when I say that the DNC, they've gone crazy, that they are openly calling for the abolition of ICE, that they're calling for open borders, they say, I don't know how many times I've been accused of this, oh, well, you're just taking the crazies. That's just the crazy people on the left. That's not the mainstream. That's not the average Democrat. That's what the deputy head of the DNC just said. Opting for open borders, saying that it's not right. It creates an injustice for people not to be able to cross the border at their leisure, at their will, regardless of who they are. So, yeah, when I say that that's a mainstream belief by the Democrats, if it's not, then the guy that's the number two guy in the DNC is in apparently direct opposition to the entirety of his party. The point is, these are not just crazy people on the fringes of the left. This is the mainstream belief of the Democrat Party, and Keith Ellison shows that. And when people refer to me and other people that are free traders as globalists, no, that's an actual globalist. Somebody that believes there should be no borders, that people should just be able to cross at any time, and we ought to be redistributing wealth across nations, and that it ought to be a free-for-all, that there ought to be no regulation, no difference between one country and the other. No, that's an actual globalist, somebody that believes there should be an international police force that's in charge of all of this. That's what a globalist looks like. Somebody that just believes in free trade, that there ought to be an exchange over the marketplace without tariffs and without, you know, all of the stuff that goes with that. That's just a free trader. That's not somebody that believes in one world government. What Ellison just proposed was international offices controlling all of that. That's what an actual globalist looks like. So it doesn't make any sense here. Another thing that he claims, which is blatantly false, is that corporations are afforded special rights. Corporations are not afforded special rights. When they move to another country, they have to go through a legal process to cross the border, which, by the way, is exactly what happens when a person wants to cross the border. If you want to cross the border, there is a legal process by which you can do that and go through the border. The same is true of a corporation. If a corporation wants to move to another country, there's a legal process that they have to start in order to move their facilities, move their labor, all of those other things, both with the country that they're in now and the country that they will be moving to, exactly like somebody who wants to move to another country and immigrate. There is a legal process for both parties. They're not afforded special rights. So what he's saying there shows a complete ignorance of business and how corporations work. Furthermore, laborers are allowed to cross the border as long as they do so in a legal fashion. There's a reason that right around rush hour, just like there is a whole bunch of traffic on I-65 when you're trying to get into Montgomery, at that same time, there is a rush hour on the border between Mexico and America and Canada and America. And the reason that there is a rush hour there is because there are people that live in Mexico that drive to Texas to go to work. And there's probably a little bit of that on the other side, although I doubt it's quite as much. But the point is, there are people that can cross the border in order to work. That's why that rush hour exists. They just ask that they do so on a legal basis and that they provide documentation when they come into our country, which is not an unreasonable thing to request. If you want to work in America, you can get a job in America, and as long as you're willing to pay taxes on that job in America and you do so in the legal process, that's fine. I don't care if you live in Mexico. I don't care if you live in Hong Kong. That's a heck of a commute. But if you want to do that, that is not a problem for me. Just do so through the proper legal channels. That's all we're asking. And let's get to this last part here, because here's the thing. What he's proposing is open borders to where anybody could cross with minimal oversight or anything like that. The truth is, long term, I actually agree with Keith Ellison. Now, I know that that's going to surprise a lot of people, especially my fellow conservative brethren, but that's the truth. I think that as a general rule, people ought to be able to cross the border at their leisure, and they will go wherever the jobs go. And I'm fine with that. I would rather labor be able to be transported from one nation to the other as a measure of free trade, just like products. I think that that would actually be a really good thing, because all of a sudden, if one country has not enough laborers and another country does, and another country has not enough jobs to provide those laborers with employment, then I don't see any reason why those laborers should not be able to cross the border And again, they already can if they go through a proper legal channel. But I would be fine with loosening that to be anybody, as long as you don't have a criminal record, you're allowed to cross the border from Mexico into America or Canada into America, and that's perfectly fine. I would be fine with them not even necessarily requiring a passport. Now, if you break the law and cross the border, then they throw the book at you just like they would if you've crossed a state border. The punishment is more severe because you're trying to escape the place where you committed a crime. Here's the thing, though. Even though I'm in favor of that policy ideally and long term, as it stands right now, that would be impossible to implement. And the reason is because we also have a massive welfare state. It's like Milton Friedman said, the celebrated economist. You can have a welfare state or you can have open borders. You can't have both. Because if you have both, then a whole bunch of people that are not paying into the system are going to come over across that border for all the free goodies that you're giving away. And many of those people are going to be not paying into the system themselves. And eventually they'll be able to vote themselves, especially since we've got the anchor baby rule. Eventually they will be able to vote themselves benefits despite not paying into the system themselves. And so this is the problem that you're running into. I'm all in favor of us being able to have a border that has minimal security, at least none more so than we require to keep ourselves safe, and allowing the average person that doesn't have a criminal record to go across anytime they want to, even if that means to go to work. I would be fine with that, but not if we have a welfare state. Because if we do that, we are taking money from the citizenry to give to the non-citizen. Because you incur all kinds of costs when it comes to infrastructure spending, when it comes to public schools, fire departments, police officers, all that stuff. You cannot offer a whole bunch of free stuff, and that's not even getting started on welfare, WIC, Social Security, all these other things. That's not even counting all of that that unfortunately illegal immigrants are able to take advantage of. That's not even counting those things. But you cannot have all those programs and offer all this free stuff to people that are not paying into the system and have an open border at the same time. So if we got rid of every dime of entitlement spending, at least at the federal level, and the federal government wanted to greatly loosen the restrictions on illegal immigration, I'd be fine with that. But until we do that, there is absolutely no way we can sustain the current level of welfare and sustain an open border at the same time. It's just mathematically not possible. And that's what Keith Ellison does not seem to understand. You know, this is the issue that I have with Ellison and people like him, people like Bernie Sanders, is that their diagnosis of the problem is usually not that far off, but their prescription is a proven failure over and over again. And that's the issue that I take with it. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with us if you want to do so. You're also, as always, welcome to tweet at Tactics Radio. That's always an option for you. If you happen to already be at work, already be in your cubicle or at your desk or wherever you may be, we certainly do welcome your comments and your tweets. So I did want to bring up a little bit of culture that's coming out. There is a movie that is coming out that is supposed to be, it's not really a documentary, it's more of a narrative. So it'd be more in line with, for example, I guess Lincoln. It's not so much a documentary film. It's supposed to be a more of a narrative format, but it's about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, the justice on the Supreme Court, the arguably the most liberal justice. I still say that Sotomayor is slightly more left than Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but she's become this like weird cult hero on the left. And I mean, there are people on the right that really like Justice Thomas. There's people on the right that really like Scalia. I happen to be in that camp. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg has reached this like weird celebrity status amongst the left and has for some time now. I mean, they've done whole pieces at CNN and MSNBC on her workout schedule. It's really strange. CNN even did a documentary not too long ago, the Notorious RBG, that was a documentary on her life, and they've never done that for any other Supreme Court justice, so I think it's pretty easy to see where their loyalties lie. But my point in all of this, it's just really strange, the kind of cult following that Ruth Bader Ginsburg gets, that people are so interested in her. And I think a lot of that has to do with the left sees the court as a vehicle for policy change, where the right really doesn't. They just see it as a last line of defense when it comes to the Constitution. But anyway, liberals have been waiting for this movie for some time. They've got an actress to play her, and she seems like a decent actress. I don't know. I haven't seen her in very much, but she's going in, and there's this whole narrative, and it's just ripe with this triumphant music or whatever. And here's a little clip of it at the end. I just can't get over this. I think that you'll see why very quickly, and you'll appreciate it. This is from the Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie. I think it's called On the Basis of Sex is the title of it. Anyway, you can look it up. I don't necessarily recommend it because it's not that good, but you can look it up. You can look up the trailer if you want to see the whole thing, but this is just the last little clip right before they go to the information about the movie.
The word woman does not appear even once in the U.S. Constitution.
Nor does the word freedom, Your Honor.
Okay, so you get the idea. It's got the big triumphant music, and that's just her big gotcha moment with a Supreme Court justice arguing in front of the Supreme Court. And wow, did she blow you away or what? That would have been an incredibly effective argument. Well, if there was any truth to it. So I take you now to the United States Constitution. I actually have my pocket constitution right in front of me. Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So, honestly, I don't know if that would have been an effective argument or not. I would need to see the argument in its entirety, in its context. I don't know what they were talking about. I don't know why they were discussing whether or not the word woman is in the Constitution or not. But the point is, if you're looking at the Constitution, it absolutely has the word freedom in there. It has the word free, which is a part of the freedom. I mean, it's one of the forms of the word freedom. And, of course, freedom itself is in the First Amendment as well. So I don't know what constitution Ruth Bader Ginsburg is reading, but if she thinks that the word freedom isn't in there, it ain't the U.S. Constitution. Now, granted, this is a character, so maybe Ruth Bader Ginsburg never said this. Maybe this particular scene is not based on anything that actually happened, which I think would actually make me feel a little bit better, because that would mean that it's just a moron Hollywood writer that's never read the Constitution, as opposed to a justice of the Supreme Court. But if this is something they're pulling from a transcript, something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually said, then that does worry me, because it shows that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not exactly well-versed on the Constitution, especially considering in the very First Amendment, the word freedom is listed pretty explicitly. Now, granted, I do have another theory on this. Maybe the reason that she does not recognize freedom as being part of the Constitution is because Ruth Bader Ginsburg does not recognize the First and Second Amendments of the Constitution, considering she seems to be pretty hostile to them. Maybe because they're in the First and Second Amendment that protects all those pesky things that she doesn't like. In this case, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and guns. Well, then you could see how especially Ruth Bader Ginsburg would just not recognize that as part of the Constitution. Or maybe because she is one of the justices that sees the Constitution as a living, evolving document, that when she reads the word freedom, she sees a completely different word. That's also possible. And actually, that would explain an awful lot if that is how Ruth Bader Ginsburg reads the Constitution. But really, you're left with only a handful of options. One is that this is something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually believes, the most terrifying of all the options. Two, she just doesn't see the word freedom in there. Three, the screenwriter that wrote that line has just never read the Constitution, which I think is the most likely, probably. But the idea that you could put that in a movie and there would be people that see it, the actress read it, there's no telling how many editors went through this, and every single one of them at every stage, not a single one thought, hey, maybe we should read the Constitution to see if that's actually true. Nobody thought to do that? Not one single person? It's not like you had to read really far into it. I mean, it's not like you had to get way into Amendment 26 or something like that. It's literally in Amendment 1 and Amendment 2. And also the word free, not freedom, but the word free does also appear in Section 2, Article 1. So again, not very far into the Constitution. So did they just not do an ounce of research for this, or what? I think that this really does show, though, that when it comes to the Constitution, as long as they don't want it to be in there, or as long as it helps their narrative, liberals do in this movie and in this trailer what they always do with the Constitution, which is, if it gets in the way of their policy, they simply ignore it. 860-1440. We'll be back in just a moment.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Sensible of the importance of Christian piety and virtue to the order and happiness of a state, I cannot but earnestly commend to you every measure for their support and encouragement. Governor John Hancock, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with me if you want to do so. You're also welcome to tweet me at Tactics Radio. There was one story that really bothered me from earlier this week, and there's really no gentle way to put this, but there is now a movement for pedophiles, and I mean actual admitted pedophiles, to get in on the ground floor when it comes to the LGBTQAII and a silent 5+ community. And I, by the way, I will say I do appreciate on the part of everybody the movement to just turn it into LGBTQ+. I think that that helps it a lot. It's still too long. There needs to be a much more concise way to say it. But nonetheless, so this community, air fingers quote, is now considering expanding to pedophiles. This is something that just happened recently. They have their own flag now. They've got a flag that it looks like the gay pride flag, but slightly different, which I find it worrisome that they're co-opting the rainbow anyway. The rainbow is a sign of the covenant between God and Noah, and I've always been bothered by the fact that the gay community likes to use it for something that God, of course, would not have approved of. But nonetheless, when it comes to this, there is a recent article that there is a new group of people trying to get a letter in this ever-expanding acronym of LGBTQAII5. I'm not just making that up. That's actually one of the forms of the acronym. I don't even know what all of them stand for anymore. But anyway, the new group that is trying to go in, they're referring to themselves as MAPS. And what MAPS are minor attracted persons. In other words, these are people that find themselves sexually attracted to minors, people that are under the age of 18. And of this group, there's four subgroups that they are now listing as part of it. And that includes people that are attracted to post-pubescence, in other words, teenagers, people that are, you know, around the age of 13 or 14 onward up until 18. There's another group within this group that refer to themselves as the pubescents, which are people that are attracted to boys and girls around the ages of 10 to 13 or 14. Then there's people that refer to themselves as prepubescents, who are attracted to kids that are younger than that age. And then there's, I forget the word for it, it's infantiles or something like that. And there are people that are sexually attracted to infants. And if that doesn't make your skin crawl, I don't know what will. But nonetheless, this group of people is now seeking acceptance in the LGBT community. And so far, most of the community has rejected them, and so I will give them credit on that. But it was only, some have actually said that they need to be accepted in, and that it was only a matter of time before this took place. After Obergefell, there were a lot of conservatives like myself that were saying, now that that sexual perversion has been largely accepted by society, you are not that far away from getting other sexual perversions included as a part of society. And what did they do? They immediately went for the transgenders. Transgender was the very first one that they were like, these people now need to be accepted. We've got the gay marriage thing. We've got all that. Now what we need to do is we need to move on and push the envelope even further and start sticking up for transgender rights. And then right after that, there was a movement to move towards polygamy, towards pedophilia. And I think that there is going to be, and there are some people that approve of this in political circles, not very many right now, that are approving of bestiality. So once there are people in this world that their ultimate goal is to have any kind of sexual perversion or activity whatsoever acceptable regardless of the circumstances surrounding it. And unfortunately, the MAPS movement is just the most recent and frankly the most disturbing of all the movements that are going on right now. And the way that they describe themselves, they're also trying to add another moniker or another label onto themselves referred to as NOMAPS, which stands for non-offending minor attracted persons. And that's supposedly people that are attracted, but they don't act on it and they don't commit any illegal acts. There are people, psychologists, all this other stuff that we've talked about this on the show a few times as well, that they actually think that when it comes to pedophilia, that should be something that is at least in a controlled environment accepted. And some people don't even add the disclaimer of a controlled environment. This is something that is going to be moved further and further into the mainstream. The movie, I think it was actually the one that won Movie of the Year last year. No, it was The Shape of Water. That was the fish sex movie where you had, and I know that this is a rough segment, but I'm just covering the news as it comes to me, where last year the Movie of the Year was actually more of a bestiality promoting thing where there's a woman who is attracted to a fish man. The one that came up in very close and people actually thought was going to be Movie of the Year was the one that was about a gay relationship between a man, a grown man, and a 17-year-old boy. And so pedophilia is slowly moving into the mainstream, and it's mostly people on the left that are pushing it into the mainstream and pushing it into acceptance. And what you're going to see is, in art and media, that age is going to move lower and lower and lower to include all of these groups, and you're going to get to the point to where there are going to be people, and I don't think it's going to be very far off, because keep in mind, Obergefell was just, I think, 2015 when that decision came down. And so, 2015, when that decision comes down, here we are only 3 years removed from it, and we're already way past where we were then, where homosexuality has a very high approval from the average person, where when it comes to transgenderism, they've already moved well into that camp and trying to get people to be accepting and approving of that. And they've already made movements towards breaking down monogamy. There was a piece, I think, in the New York Times. I want to say it's the New York Times. You can double check me on this. But there was a piece in the New York Times just recently that was talking about a woman that brought, she has two kids and she was married and brought another man into their house to live with them. Now, big surprise, at the end of the piece, it turns out that her old husband moved out because he couldn't deal with it, because more than two people in a relationship, that just never works out. It never works out to the good of anybody. There's always problems that comes with that. Polygamy is a problem, and it's not part of God's original design. But that being said, these are all things that are being pushed back into the mainstream because we were accepting, and frankly, I think part of this is a problem with the church. Because the church, for a very long time, Christians like myself, for a very long time, and I'm not saying that this is all Christians, but there were large portions of what we would refer to as the larger Christian umbrella that remained completely silent when it came to things like marriage, divorce, remarriage. And eventually, because we did not take a strong stance on that, because we did not come out and openly condemn that as strongly as we needed to at the onset of it, when this thing started trending this way, because we did not defend the sanctity of marriage as we should have, then we started having problems with other perversions of marriage popping up. And unfortunately, this is the latest unintended consequence, I think, in large part, of that problem. So now you've got pedophiles seeking open endorsement and approval of the gay community, and I think that before long, maybe within just a few years, you're going to have people that are accepting that. Now, again, that's a prediction from me. My predictions aren't always right, but I think based on just reading the tea leaves, that is the direction, unfortunately, that we're going. Okay, I do have to take a break here, but it looks like we have a caller on, so real quickly, I will try to get a caller in. Good morning. What's your name?
This is Mike.
Hey, Mike, what do you think this morning? What's on your mind?
Well, I tell you, and to be brief, I'm not surprised that, you know, the perversion of the day is being flouted, Hollywood, and it's just one more thing for me not to watch, since I haven't really watched any movies in really years. Hollywood, there's no attraction for me anymore. And they don't even get history right. You know,
that's true.
So, me being a historian at all, I usually used to watch any movies based on history that come out, but they can't even get those right anymore. So, you know, I just read, I guess, mostly, or watch C-SPAN, or whatever. You know, and that's,
well, you're probably better off if you spend more time reading, Mike, to be honest. But yeah, I got to say, even though I'm a big movie fan, radio, TV, and film, that was part of my major, and so I took some film classes. I'm somebody that consumes a lot of media, but it does get hard when you feel like your values are just constantly under attack. I was watching a show the other night. It was the big crossover event that they have between The Flash and The Arrow, you know, all those superhero series that are on the CW now. And right, there are scenes that I'll just fast forward because it's just prominent, in your face, making characters gay that aren't even gay in the comic books. They just feel like they've got to ram that down your throat, and so they have to include it in everything. And I've gotten to the point where I'll just fast forward through several giant blocks of a show because I don't want to see it. It's not entertaining to me.
Yeah, I just get tired of being lectured to, especially by people who don't really know what they're talking about.
True.
So I just turn it off, and I've been ordering some really great books, you know, Edmund Burke and things like that, and just going back to reading the basics of American political thought.
Hey.
And that's what I've been doing lately. So, you know, I mean, that's how I entertain myself these days.
All right. Well, more power to you, Mike. I appreciate the call. And if you got to pick something to read, Edmund Burke is a good choice. I am a big fan of philosophy, and so if you got to pick somebody to read, you might as well be doing that. That's probably more beneficial than, even though that this would be more my style, watching the newest Avengers movie, although I have to say I am very much looking forward to Avengers 4. But anyway, thank you so much for the call, Mike. I appreciate it. And yeah, that's part of the problem that I have with it too. I mean, I'm constantly bombarded by this stuff day in and day out. And when it comes to the average person, they're just wanting to get home, watch something that they can watch with their kids without having to give an explanation of everything or have to hit mute or fast forward. So this is why the average American that does have traditional Christian values feels like they're under attack all the time. They can't even sit down and watch a TV program with their own kids after a long day of work. They can't just sit down and veg out. They've still got to, even there, deal with the virtue signaling and the constant political lectures. And that's why a lot of people check out. And frankly, I have a hard time blaming them for that. I think that they're probably doing the better thing, cutting themselves off or at least greatly limiting their consumption of that, like Mike is talking about. And I understand it. Anyway, we'll be back with the Chaplain's Report. That's coming up in just a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with me. As Christians, I do think that sometimes we speak as though we do not believe in the power of prayer. I don't think it's intentional. I don't think anybody's doing so maliciously. But I think sometimes, just as a force of habit, sometimes our speech patterns and the way that we convey things and the way that we talk about prayer sometimes conveys a disbelief or at least a faith that is not very strong in the power of prayer. I know that I've been, as a minister, with so many families that have dealt with something that's really difficult, especially a loved one that is ailing or sick in some way, or they get into a really bad place and they'll say, well, all we can do is pray. And I understand what they're saying there, and I understand what they mean by that. But to the average person, I do want us to be careful about how we say that, because doesn't it sound like, well, we've exhausted all other options, so I guess the only thing left that we can do is pray? Shouldn't prayer be our first resort? Shouldn't we go there first before anything else? Shouldn't prayer be the thing that we rely on the most, even more so than modern medical care or anything else? See, prayer should always be the place where we go to before we try anything else. I'm not saying you don't try other things. I mean, I'm an example of that. With all the treatment and all the time that I've spent in the cancer center and hospitals and getting surgeries. But we do need to, I think, convey when we're talking about prayer, when we're talking about it to other people, and especially when there may be non-believers in earshot, talk about it in such a way that conveys that we have a strong belief in what prayer can do. And I know that I've also heard people say things like, well, now he's in God's hands. Well, good. Isn't that exactly where you want to be? I got to tell you, if I'm sick, that's exactly where I want to be. I don't want to be anywhere else. We should all have a desire to want to be in God's hands, especially in times of crisis. Again, I'm not saying that there's any malicious intent behind this. These are phrases that I've uttered before I really thought about them and the way that they come off to other people. I'm just saying I think that adjusting our language and tweaking it just a little bit can convey a stronger faith in God's power, His providence, and what can come about by prayer. And this largely comes from a passage in James chapter 5, verses 13 through 15. Is anyone among you suffering? Then he must pray. Is anyone cheerful? He is to sing praises. Is anyone among you sick? Then he must call for the elders of the church, and they are to pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer offered in faith will restore the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. And if he has committed sins, they will be forgiven him. So look at what that verse was saying. It says that if somebody is sick, if there is an ailment there, then it is the members of the church, the brothers and sisters in Christ, they are the ones that are supposed to immediately go to him, and they anoint him with oil, which, by the way, that was a medical practice back then. So they're saying, look, you administer care. That doesn't mean you ignore care, but primarily that you offer up prayers and God will heal him. Now, he may heal him in a physical way. He may heal him in a spiritual way. But the point is, when he's in God's hands, he's going to be all right regardless of how the prayer turns out and how that prayer is answered. God is the kind of father that does know our needs, but he's also the kind of father that likes to be asked, that likes to know that we depend on him, we rely on him, and that we have faith that he can deliver when we make request of him. I firmly believe in the power of prayer. In fact, I'm convinced that I would not be alive today were it not for prayer. And maybe even if modern medicine had had the ability to help me out, it certainly did not have the power, because I had stage 3 cancer, which is the highest form of cancer for testicular cancer. And yet my side effects were minimal. It barely interrupted my life except for a couple weeks there at the end. And I made a full recovery after just one round of chemo. I believe that all the prayers and the thoughts, which, by the way, I thank the audience for those of you who did that for me as well. I think that that had a lot to do with my amazing and speedy recovery. I believe in prayer, and I believe that it's the reason that I am here today, because God would never ask us to do anything that's meaningless. God would never instruct us to do something that does not have a purpose and does not directly benefit us. Prayer is incredibly meaningful to him, but it's also meaningful to us. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.